Hello and welcome to Mixed Feelings, a podcast brought to you by the Collaborative Research Center Affective Societies at Freie Universität Berlin. My name is Paulina Aronson. I'm a sociologist, a journalist, and the public relations lead here at the research center. I'm especially excited to launch today's episode, not just because it's our very first, but because we're diving straight into one of the most powerful and puzzling emotions of all, love. Of all the mixed feelings out there, this one might be just the most mixed. Wherever you look, everyone is talking about love. It's in pop songs, it's in rom-coms, it's above all in merchandise, because so many products these days are branded as made with love. This obsession with love isn't exactly new, but the way we talk about love today is quite different from how our grandparents or their grandparents talked about it. The idea of romantic love as we inherited it from the past no longer feels quite so convincing. Instead, we're caught somewhere between utopian dreams and outward pessimism, searching for relationship models that might finally free us from gender inequality, heteronormativity, and the weight of outdated roles. From friendship with benefits to polyamorous unions and feminist co-housing projects, new forms of intimacy and care are emerging that rethink what it means to live and love together outside the nuclear family. So what happens when we take love out of its traditional frame? Can utopian ideas really reshape how we live? And what role do literature and pop culture play in shaping or challenging our ideas about intimacy, care, and commitment? Are we still living out old scripts, or are we finally writing new ones? To help us think through these questions, we've brought together two guests whose work looks at love from very different but deeply connected angles through literature, history, activism, and personal experience. They each bring a unique perspective on how we imagine, live, and challenge love in all its contradictions as longing, as belonging, as utopia, and as everyday practice. Geza Jessen is a literary scholar at the CRC Affective Societies. She studied comparative literature and art history and wrote her PhD on nature and literature after romanticism. Geza, your current work explores the politics of emotion in reading, the contested nature of love, and the afterlife of romanticism, all the topics that we really want to talk about today. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And our second guest is Olle Liebl, a blogger and also a fellow podcaster who writes and produces videos and texts on feminist topics. And he is also the author of a book called Freunde lieben, or Loving Your Friends, in which he explores the role of eroticism in friendship and the ways we draw boundaries between different forms of affection and intimacy in our lives. And it's great to have you here, Olle.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
So let's begin with a big picture question. What influence do radical utopian ideas actually have on modern concepts of love and family? Because love is often imagined as something deeply personal, but it's also deeply political. And throughout history, and especially in literature, we've seen attempts to imagine love as a force of transformation, as a force of belonging. And it's not just about passion or romance, but about the deep potential of love to reshape how we relate to each other also in everyday life. And as Goethe put it, Wahlverwandtschaften, we're recording this podcast in Germany, so there will be a lot of German words. Elective affinities, Wahlverwandtschaften, can create new forms of kinship beyond ties or marriage contracts. And my first question goes to Geza. Queer and feminist literatures often challenge traditional ideas of romance and intimacy and the nuclear family. How does love come across in these texts, in these essays, in this poetry? What is love for these authors?
So for me as a literary scholar, it's always really interesting to ask, what does love do as a literary device? And how does the traditional love script work in order to understand what queering it or what subverting it through feminist writing could look like? And you mentioned Goethe's Wahlverwandtschaften, elective affinities, which tells the story of a formerly calm and amicable marriage then being broken up and destroyed by intense passions for other people. And this text, as well as another one of Goethe's love texts that I immediately think of when I hear Goethe and love, The Sorrows of Young Werther, both of them are quite good examples for a formula that Anne Carson has described in her essay Eros the Bittersweet, in which Carson kind of identifies as the blueprint for how love has usually been depicted in the European literary tradition. And so Carson describes this triangle that, yeah, develops between the loving subject, the beloved object, and the obstacle that keeps both of them from merging into complete harmony. And this triangle creates tension and excitement, and it brings forth specific forms of literature and prose and poetry. And it does not necessarily have to be centered around heterosexual desire. Carson looked at the poems of Sappho, which give shape to lesbian longing. But what they all do is they imply a certain kind of subjectivity, a kind of subjectivity that is yearning and struggling for more, always orientated towards the future, in a pursuit of personal fulfillment, even if it comes with tragedy in the end. And queer feminist love writing, I think, often doesn't look like what we expect from a typical love story, because it does not necessarily follow this formula. So if we look at an historical example from the 15th century, Christine de Bizan's The Book of the City of Ladies, this is a response to a popular romantic text of that time, The Romance of the Rose, but it doesn't look like a traditional love story. City of Ladies envisions a society built by women, and it talks about education, it champions female companionship. So it's about building a society as an answer to this idea of love that has been described in Romance of the Rose. Or another historical example from the 19th century would be the Gabrielle by George Sand, which tells the story of this protagonist, Gabrielle, who lives as a woman in the countryside experiencing love, but then lives as a man in the city experiencing public life and politics and economics. Or a more recent example, perhaps, from our time, to me, would be Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts, which tells the story of multiple transitions, a transition through a romantic relationship and partnership, a gender transition, and also a transition into parenthood through pregnancy. And none of these texts, I think, are usually considered canonical love stories, precisely because they don't follow this traditional formula and they don't have this kind of subjectivity and this kind of struggle at their center. But yeah, instead they leave this conventional script of eros behind that Carson has described, which leads to very different texts and very different subjectivities and different forms of love.
May I ask something about it? Yeah. Because when I now envision this triangle of a subject struggling and having an object of love, it seems to me that the Book of the City of Ladies doesn't really have a fixed object of love. It seems to be more like a society or many people or a form of getting together. And with the Argonauts, it's not a subject that is loving, but more like the subject is like in motion and changes and shifts all the time. So is it maybe this kind of spectralization of the triangle that it opens up this subject and object positions?
I think so. I think what all these texts do is work with subjectivity in a different manner. I mean, the Argonauts is also, when we look at the genre, kind of a mixture of theoretical essay and life writing. So it's already defying genre conventions in order to kind of talk about how subjectivity is created through both discourse and experience. And part of that experience or that discourse can be the experience of love or the discourse around love, but it's not this goal that's somewhere in the future and that kind of drives the whole story. It's more something that is experienced in very different ways throughout the text.
I think also this dichotomy of different subjects is very much about what we talked about when we're preparing this podcast. And you know, we had this little misunderstanding between the concepts of longing and belonging. We just kind of misheard each other when we spoke about that. And it seems like these ideas of the city of ladies and the communities built on companionship, they're very much about belonging. And it seems like the traditional idea that love must be about longing necessarily, it must be about obsession, that very early on, women are trying to divorce themselves from this idea and say, okay, we don't want this, actually. This is not what we think is love, and this leave it to the men. They want to construct it this way, fine. And I wanted to ask you, Geza, about your latest research on novels by Constance Debré, the author, which seems to be extremely provocative in how she just dismisses the whole idea of longing. And she says, no emotional work anymore, no suffering, none of this. We don't want this anymore. This is how women should see emancipation. Do I understand it right?
I mean, I think there's definitely an aspect to Constance Debré's work that, yeah, kind of goes in that direction of saying no to emotional investment and emotional labor in a sense that's not beneficial to the self, but that's more like relationship building. So Constance Debré wrote these three autofictional, I think she doesn't call them autofictional, novels, Name, Playboy, and Love Me Tender, which all talk about what it feels like to walk away from a bourgeois life, a heterosexual marriage, parenthood in your 40s, and instead start out this bohemian, new, radical life as a writer, smoking lots of cigarettes, going swimming, having sex with all these women, but not necessarily entering into a committed relationship. And in Love Me Tender, the main question that kind of starts off the text is, how do we break up with love? How can we live out passions and feelings and experiences, but not really love? But then what kind of happens throughout the text is that in the end, the narrator kind of mellows out a bit, I think. And the last page is musing on, maybe it's not so bad to be loved after all. Maybe it's also all right. Maybe it's okay to accept love, and maybe things don't have to be so complicated. So I think it's a mixture of both things. It's on one hand, kind of thinking about what would it mean to not put love and maybe not one relationship or commitment at the center of your life. But it also acknowledges that it's probably also, for a lot of people, kind of a comfortable, nice thing to have.
I thought about that when you talk now about this subject, that love is a very powerful emotions, and every powerful emotions is somehow attacked, or it is trying to be transformed by powers and politics. And I see that love comes with a burden, especially heterosexual love for women, with the burden of, you know, sustaining a family, getting children, rearing them and stuff. And if you want to escape these powers that come with love in our society, then it's obvious that you want to flee that. But it's also inevitable to love and to be loved, because it's a very human condition, independent of which powers address it or try to manipulate it or instrumentalize it. So maybe it's, you know, this struggle between how to escape the political implications. Also, if we talk about emotion work, I mean, emotion work is one thing where there's an obvious imbalance in the relationship, but it doesn't mean that we don't want to emotionally care for other people. I mean, of course, we want to care for the people that we love, and this is not a work, and we don't see it as work. But if there is an imbalance, this surplus, you know, between, you know, what is normal and what is, you know, really made out of love, and what is, you know, demanded because of a power imbalance, this is what emotion work basically is. So it's not escaping love altogether. It's about, you know, these power struggles.
I think bringing power into it is really, really important and really interesting. And in the context of Constance Debré's writing, it's also interesting that the narrator or the protagonist of these books loses a lot of security and comfort by walking away from this bourgeois heterosexual marriage. She doesn't have money, she crashes on friends' couches, she sometimes steals food or cigarettes. So yeah, there is a very real loss of comfort and security, but also this is something this narrator, this character, can afford to do, because she's still a white woman who's very well educated. So that also comes with certain privileges and securities. And yet it's a negotiation between giving up a certain lifestyle and being more at risk and being perhaps more precarious. And yeah, I am also wondering how this plays out in the kind of relationships that you wrote about, loving friends, because I think the pull of sort of committed, strictly romantic relationships often also is this day-to-day comfort of having a shared flat and shared responsibilities and maybe shared financial assets. And yeah, do you think loving your friends then implies sort of a greater risk-taking because there is not this power structure that kind of upholds monogamous relationships or romantic? Yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, let's stick with the friendship first, before we, you know, take care of the sexual part when it comes to friends with benefits. But it's an open question how you live in friendships. I mean, there is no law that forbids to live together with your friends and also share apartments. I think many people do, especially in their younger years, especially when they are in university, you know, or they find a flat and then find friends there. And you can also share your income and you can share your house and you can share your kids and whatever. You can even have kids, I mean, under certain biological conditions. But there's no law that forbids it to do all these things with friends. I see the point that it's easier by law to just have a marriage and have a family and share your, you know, assets in that way. Also, like, really what you own income-wise, pension-wise and stuff. But... And there's also the expectations that society has of how people should live together. And if they do it in a certain form, they should be a romantic union and not just friends. I see this, but friendship in itself has no borders when it comes to that. It would be possible. And this is also some kind of a utopian sense in every friendship, because friendship as an institution is not so much confronted with expectations by society, but also not so much surrounded by powers or governments that try to control friendship. Because it is no institutionalized relationship and there are no ambitions to institutionalize these relationships. So yeah, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you have these many possibilities and more freedom than in classic romantic relationships. But on the other hand, you know, things are difficult because of that.
It's a really interesting topic. And I think that what makes a difference between what we are used to understanding as romantic love and friendship is the inherently different understanding of debt that we have to each other in these relationships. I came up with this idea a few years ago when I first did interviews about love and ideas of love and relationships in Russia before the full-scale invasion into Ukraine. That was in 2020. And 80% of the interviews, all the 80% of the material in these interviews was about the feeling of debt, the feeling of being indebted in a love relationship. And young Russian people protested against being in debt to someone in a relationship. We don't owe anything to anyone. That was basically one phrase that we as interviewers heard again and again, again and again. And it made me think back then that it would be interesting to analyze it through the lens of debt moral. So I looked at David Graeber's approach to debt at the three types of debt moral, where he distinguishes between this three types of debt moral: the hierarchical debt moral, where you are confronted with an idea that you are indebted to somebody because it just has to be this way. It's a traditional patriarchal debt moral, and I think this is what people are really protesting against. And where they want to move on to is the debt moral of exchange, where you are always trying to have a blank slate. I give to you, you give to me, and we're trying to keep a complete equilibrium. And this is in part what pop psychology is teaching us a lot. You know, you have to invest into relationships and you have to get return of investments, otherwise it just doesn't work. So any kind of disbalance in these investments is causing discomfort, concern, something is off, something is wrong. People don't want to have these kind of disbalanced relationships when it comes to love.
Do you remember the third type?
It has to do directly with friendship. You know, the third type of moral, of that moral David Graeber is writing about is everyday communism. And he spends a lot of time and a lot of pages on explaining why his communism is not the communism of Vladimir Lenin or, you know, anyone else. And he's trying to say communism is basically any kind of behavior that is based on the principle from everybody according to their capacities and to everybody according to their needs. And in friendship, actually, we often live according to this rule. We don't really count what we have given and what we give back. There is an intuitive sense that there is some common good and stuff just goes around. But we don't do it in romantic love.
When I just listened to you talking about the young Russians exchanging the hierarchical debt moral with the exchange debt moral, I immediately thought, you're just exchanging the hierarchy of a patriarchal system, maybe, that you identify with hierarchical debt moral, with the hierarchy of a capitalistic mode of exchange. And so you just switch the modes, but the hierarchies or the power structures, although they are, you know, differently framed, stay intact. So I'd highly advise, if we talk about love and romantic love, to really go with this thing of communion, of trust, exchange, not in the sense of, you know, having a blank slate, but exchange of trusting that when time will be there, good will come to me and I will offer something good. It's not about, you know, being traders of goods, but really just offering something as gifts and trusting that other will make a gift to me.
And is it what happens in what you call Freundschaft Plus? Is it what is happening in the so-called friendships with benefits?
I'd say it happens in friendships generally more often. In friendships, we don't behave like exchanging traders, but really as offering gifts to each other constantly. I think it was in the Paulus, in the letter of Paulus, where it says that God doesn't love you because you're good, but it says that you're good because you're loved. And I like this, you know, turning this around. It's not that you, you know, have to do something in order to be loved. You don't have to, you know, I constantly try to, you know, bring something on the table. I can just be loved the way I am. And then, you know, happens more or less. I think if an ideal of friendship would be that, and also an idea of sexual friendships. I mean, I talked about sexual friendships, or I wrote this book about it, because it's very interesting to see how the moral frames and the political views on both friendship and sexuality change thoroughly throughout the last, I don't know, centuries. Until we came to a point where these relationships are possible nowadays, or that they are widespread, that people discuss about it openly without fearing to be, you know, questioned by the church or the Inquisition or whatever, or being burned as witches, we can do these things nowadays. And so it's more like a perspective, or the relationship types opens up a perspective on huge societal changes, which I thought to be interesting. But at the core, if you really take the friendship part seriously, a sexual friendship is like any other friendship in the regard of the, you know, debt.
To be honest, for me, or somebody who comes from the former socialist bloc, the idea of discovery of sexual friendship here in the West is a little bit surprising that it is surprising to me that it comes as a surprise in the West that, oh, this is possible. Because I think in under socialism, the idea that friendships can be sexual was a lot more acceptable. And in general, sex was perceived in a very different way. And I think still Soviet Union was a very special place in that sense. You know, I don't think we can really put everything on the same level and say, okay, GDR, former GDR, Bulgaria, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Soviet Union was all the same. No, it wasn't. It definitely wasn't. But in particularly in East Germany, as we can see from research done, for example, by Christine Godsey, who wrote a fantastic book called Why Women Had Better Sex Under Socialism, we see that actually the idea that friendship can be sexualized was absolutely acceptable and outwear. So what happened to it? How is it possible that now after 30 years after reunification in Germany, it again comes as almost as a societal utopia?
But I think it might have also been there and then kind of was disregarded along the way. Because I think in the 60s and early 70s, if you look at literary endeavors into free love, but also into social practices of people at that time, I think there was this idea that sexuality does not have to only happen in a marriage or in one relationship. And I mean, it also coincides with ideas about communal living and communal childcare and, you know, sharing resources and finances. And I was just reminded of a book that was recently republished, but that was originally written in the late 60s, early 70s by Fee Chocker, this West German writer and journalist. It's called He or I. And she wrote about all the romantic relationships she had up until a certain point, starting when she was a teenager. And then she went to all these partners or former partners and asked them for their version of the story. And then she put both versions in a book. And I remember in one of the stories, she always had conflicts with her boyfriend's best friend. And then her boyfriend was like, yeah, maybe you should just, you know, sleep with him. Get it out. You know, maybe this will resolve the conflict. And that was in the late 60s. And so it's not like those ideas that maybe sexuality doesn't have to be in this one relationship and it would be threatening to the friendships, but that maybe instead it could, you know, maybe the idea that sexuality doesn't have to necessarily only happen in one relationship, but that it can not only be something to be explored with other people, but actually help friendships to flourish. I think that idea might have been around there already. And then, yeah, so the question is, what happened then?
I think we always have to differentiate between what is the discourse or what are the topics that people talk about and what are the actual relationships that people have. I'm convinced that people desired and also lived out that desire for bodily intimacy with their friends since the beginning of time. I mean, nowadays we live in big cities and we open up Tinder and we can, or any other dating app, and we swipe 1,000 of people that we never saw, that we will never see again. And it's completely anonymous. And the idea that we pick out sexual partners from a huge anonymous mass is something that was spawned, you know, in cities of millions. But most of, the time that humans exist on this earth, which has traveled around in smaller groups from 50 to 150 people. I mean, I live on the countryside. If I open any dating app, I'm done in 5 minutes, you know, in the radius of 50 kilometers. So I know everyone who's around. So, if you want to find people that you have sex with, you usually, you know, are in contact with them or they are friends of friends. And, you know, this is how people lived. So to say that sexual friendship is an invention of modern times, I think quite the opposite is true. Forgetting about friends with benefits is a sign of modern times.
Yeah, I think what dating apps have brought to, in a way, like a social process that they brought to completion is the divorce between social and sexual. They just don't meet anymore. Often also are not allowed to meet because we, for better for worse, you know, we have reasons to suspect that there are the risks of mixing social and sexual, like, you know, romance at workplace, romance in institutions of education. All of this can have also strong side effects, particularly for women, particularly for queer people. It can be disadvantaging to a lot of people. And in a way, it seems that it's more safe, it's more comfortable, it's for progressive to completely separate between the two. So there is a playground with your social thing and there is a playground with your sexual thing.
But only love, romantic love, is allowed to contain both.
It's true. Yeah, this is what, you know, the social norm is. Only the romantic love is allowed to contain both. And I think what also is happening in this chasm between social and sexual is that there is very little place for longing, for romantic obsession, you know, and it doesn't mean that it has disappeared. It is taking new forms. And for example, one of the most persistent trends in social media these days is the so-called delusionment, the imaginary relationships, the pursuit of the impossible. People who, like Madame Bovary 200 years ago, are obsessed with a love story that maybe never really happened to them, but they imagine that it happened and they're aspiring to it. And in a way, it is really quite impressive how a notion that is very negatively loaded, delusionment, actually acquired positive meaning, that you can aspire to something, you can fantasize about something, and you know, you can maybe even manifest love into your life. And Ole, I wanted to ask you, you are, among other things, also content creator for social media. Do you notice these trends? Like, how do people express their longing, their romantic obsessions? What is really happening out there?
I mean, of course I see people, you know, putting something on the net, but then I'm an observer as anyone else. But what I experience as a creator is that I publish videos that people see in their everyday life, when they wake up, when they go to bed, when they take a shit, when they, you know, sit in the kitchen, when they wait for a doctor's appointment. So I am part of their life together with many other creators. But, you know, they recognize my face. They recognize the topics that I say. Sometimes they discuss it with people. And sometimes they are messaging me. And so I'm woven into their intellectual, into their social fabric. And they, of course, have a parasocial relationship to me, especially the people who are, you know, following me for a longer time and enjoying my content. Which means only because I am part of their life, a certain type of trust builds. So people text me or, you know, send DMs to me with very personal problems, with very personal histories, with questions about their relationships, about sexuality, because I also talk about these subjects. And, you know, sometimes I answer them in a very formal and professional way. And also if people recognize me on the street, they say, oh, hey, hi, and basically they are very, you know, excited, but then they don't know what to say because we don't know each other. I don't know them. So the intimacy is pretty much one-sided. You could say it's an illusion of intimacy, but why is intimacy an illusion or delusion? We could talk about the difference between the two words. I'm not so sure where the difference lies. Only because it's one-sided, but where's the problem? I mean, love can be real when it's one-sided. Intimacy can be real when it's one-sided. Hate can be real when it's one-sided. So I'm not sure whether I would talk about an illusion. It's just a way that people react to other humans, even if they are just on the screen. So, yeah, it's a performance that I do. So in a way, I create an illusion of a coherent persona. I mean, I also sit here, I'm prepared to talk about the subject, that I know roughly the questions that you're asking me. So, of course, I can perform my, you know, intellectual awareness, the theories, the information, in a sense that are very coherent and concise and everything. And people say, oh, wow, what a smart and friendly person. But maybe I'm not.
I confirm. He's a certified smart and charming person.
In being a public person, I create an illusion, but the relationship that people have to this illusion can be real and it's not a delusion. I think that would be too much.
I think that's also interesting about the term delusion, that as soon as people use it in a self-conscious manner and say, oh yeah, this is my delusionship, I'm Delulu, it's not a proper delusion in the pathological sense anymore, because, you know, as soon as you're aware of it happening, you're not completely in the delusion. And the psychoanalyst Donald Woods Winnicott described delusion as a failure to play, which I think is a really interesting definition, because we would think, delusion, the opposite of it is reality. But no, for Winnicott, it's play. So the ability to kind of navigate this area between fantasy and reality, and to kind of be able to engage with this in a playful manner. And I think this is what is happening when people are talking about, oh, my delusionship, I'm just being delulu about this.
No, wait, just to get this right. Delusion means to play or to not be able to play?
For Winnicott, and I mean, Winnicott is talking about psychoanalytic practices. So people who are in a proper delusion believe, I don't know, that the television is talking to them. And it's not a game. It's, you know, it's serious. Exactly. If they are kind of playing with this idea of the people in the TV are talking to me, then it's not a delusion. Then they're successful at navigating fantasy and reality. You know, not being in... So you're delusional if you can't play. If you can play, you know, you're safe. you're not going to fall into the trap of complete delusion. So I think the way people are using the term delusion and delusionship now is not a pathological delusion, because it is playful and it is self-aware and it is self-conscious. I read an article the other day on The Guardian about people who are in relationships with an artificial intelligence. And all of these people are very aware that this is something else than having a relationship with a person who's in the same room as you, having a physical relationship or not physical relationship. But they are very aware. So I think this also... It's interesting that people can have these really intense emotions and really intense relationships or parasocial relationships, and they're still aware kind of what's happening. They're not completely, you know, they don't really think that you know them. Yeah. But yeah, it still feels like you might know them.
But then we can make up three terms now that make sense. If we are surrounded by illusions and we believe in illusions, which is completely fine. And if we are fixated on them and we don't, you know, we cannot play anymore, we are delusional. But if we know it and can somehow name it and play with it, we are delulu. So maybe being delulu, being delusional, and believing in illusions are three different things that have to be separated, you know.
But in a way, you know, this self-term... Delulu, you know, this self-attribution of delusionment to oneself. It's kind of, in a way, reclaiming stigma. It functions as a reclaiming stigma, and longing and obsession is seen by contemporary emotional culture as a kind of stigma these days quite often. So this is interesting to me, that this movement of delulu, this trend of delulu is happening, is gaining popularity right at this point of the time when we're being very often told to treat love like an investment portfolio, you know, diversify, optimize, reduce your emotional risk, etc. And the inability to do so is being classified as a delusionment. And we see it, for example, also in new reinterpretations of classical literature. I don't know how many times already I have run into pop psychologists talking about Romeo and Juliet, that all of this should be burned and nobody should ever read it because it's complete trash and it just totally brainwashes our youth, and they didn't have any personal boundaries. They had no understanding of healthy relationships. You know, same goes for pretty much any classic romantic novel, you know, any piece of literature that is considered to be classical. And if you look at Russian literature, which I grew up with, it's a little shop of horrors, you know, if you take a look at it from the contemporary perspective of healthy relationships and investment into relationship, personal growth in a relationship, risk avoidance, pain avoidance, you know. Geza, how does it look like in contemporary literature? Is there at all any space for longing and obsession and suffering and everything that gets packed with certain sarcastic note, self-sarcastic note, self-annihilating note as delusionment?
Yes and no, probably. I mean, I think for longing, certainly. If we look at the bestseller lists in not only in Germany but also internationally, it's quite clear that people are deliberately approaching literature looking for a literary experience of longing, of romance. I mean, there are always romance novels, designated romance novels now on the bestseller list. And this reflects changes in the literary landscape and the book market on one hand, because there are more readers now who are women or non-binary people, also more writers and communities on BookTok and Instagram and Goodreads who are not dominated by men. And this brought forth a new popularity and a new rewriting of certain genres that had been traditionally associated with a female readership. But it also reflects a changing attitude towards reading and towards what people kind of want to get out of reading. And it's interesting if we look at responses in articles when people were asked why they read romance novels. And some of these readers really said, I read romance novels because dating in real life is so disappointing or even dangerous. So literature becomes a place to experience or think about or explore certain emotions without the risk of disappointment or very real violence attached. There's a Reddit thread that I looked at a while ago where one romance novel reader asked others, "Why do you read romance?" And most people answered by saying, "Because I like the security of the happy ending." There's even an abbreviation for it, HE, happy ending. And people really resonate with this idea of whatever happens in this book, whatever kind of obsessive, all-consuming, romantic, crazy things are happening, it will still be contained, there will still be a happy ending. And what I remember one response, one person saying, "I really don't want to be confronted with violence and sexism and racism when I'm trying to relax, when I'm reading. I want to experience these positive emotions." And I mean, this is not completely new. People have always also approached literature looking for escapism. But it did make me kind of think of a certain need for security and for containment. Maybe it's new, maybe it's just being vocalized more. But yeah, there definitely seemed to be kind of an inclination towards the happy ending, even if it is in the context of very intense emotional storytelling.
It's also longing for culmination, I think, you know? And I have to think my favorite example, I think, in this attachment to happy ending is the history or the story of probably one of the most famous love films ever, Breakfast at Tiffany, which is based on a novel by Truman Capote, which ends in a very different way than the film. And Hollywood just wouldn't take it. They couldn't suck it up. So she has to find the love of her life, the last moment, and be reintegrated into the world of people who go to Tiffany and buy beautiful things.
In the movie, I have neither seen the movie nor read the novel, so I didn't really get the difference now.
The protagonist, played by Audrey Hepburn, she finds her real love and everything goes well for her.
I mean, even the cat survives.
And in the novel, everyone dies. Everyone dies except for the cat.
The final scene in the movie is both the protagonist and the love interest running out into the rain looking for her cat. And then they're all united in this kind of like, and it's sort of like a nuclear family in a back alley of New York.
Most of relationships that people actually go through in their lives, they are not a kind of a plot for a rom-com or for a novel. They are, you know, garden variety of boredom. And it's interesting that since recently, sociologists and literary scholars actually started looking at what people are calling boring relationships, and there is more interest into that because this is a huge part of our life that is behind the scenes. We don't really know how to conceptualize it. Maybe the couples therapists are the ones who like talking about that. And, you know, one of my favorite persons out there, Esther Perel, she talks about maintenance sex, for example. But we don't really have narratives. We don't really have stories about just run-of-the-mill every day.
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of goes back to this triangular shape of love as a literary device, that in order to create tension and hold interest and have suspense, which is what a lot of literature tries to do, you kind of have to have these obstacles. You have to have a struggle. You have to have some sort of complication. You know, Odysseus can't just go straight back to Penelope. He has to face all these adventurous obstacles in order for there to be a story. I think that's just a common literary formula, which doesn't mean that there aren't literary endeavors that kind of experiment with this or try to subvert this or do something else. I recently read All Fours by Miranda July, and I think that is a really interesting take on some of these love and obsession tropes, because a big part of that book talks about the narrator being obsessed with this young man that she randomly meets in the small town where she hides in a hotel room while she pretends to her husband and their child and her friends that she's really on a cross-country trip to New York where she's supposed to present a book, I think. But yeah, so there is this obsessive love, but then the story kind of diverts and it doesn't go in the direction of tragedy or a happy ending, but instead it tells the story of a transition of a long-term committed marriage where the narrator and her husband then in the end kind of figure out, well, you know, maybe we should do things differently, we should probably open up our marriage, but kind of stay together and live together with our kid. And it's this sort of like anticlimactic ending that you didn't really see coming throughout the story, because yeah, a lot of the story deals with this trope of obsession and longing and really intense passionate feelings. And in the end, the narrator chooses a very different path and kind of, yeah, chooses maybe not boredom, but the ordinary, the mundane, the day-to-day. Well, but this really works for us. We like each other. We kind of want to salvage this marriage. We don't want to run off into the sunset necessarily.
It makes me think of research that I am currently doing, in the midst of doing, with a Russian colleague of mine. We're looking at love stories of Russians after the beginning of the full-scale invasion into Ukraine, and we're interviewing people who both left Russia, who stayed in Russia, we're interviewing people who are in relationships, cross borders, etc. And we actually have a whole category of people who say in interviews, oh, well, maybe you sociologists won't even be interested in talking to us because our situation is just so boring. And as my friend and colleague who does this work with me, her name is Anna Kuleshova, how she was the first one to notice that, to point it out and say, actually, these stories are the most interesting ones because they survive. Those are the stories that long, that have the most complex temporality. These are the stories that actually withstand all the difficulties. There are very little culminations there and ups and downs. There are ups and downs, but they're not spiking. And it is very much about maintenance, and it is very much about the mundane and problem solving and taking, as you have said, the different path. When we were thinking about that, we thought about the concept of cruel optimism suggested by Laurent Berlin. And we may think probably about the happy ending, the traditional happy ending stories, as a form of cruel optimism, you know, some form of distraction that offers us a fantasy that can never be really pursued and that is probably detrimental to our own everyday happiness. And while we were analyzing all the stories, we thought about of a different concept, the kind pessimism, you know, the actually acceptance of what is and the possibility of remaining kind, compassionate, empathetic to each other while embracing the understanding that probably things won't run into a happy end, that probably we're heading somewhere else.
Kind pessimism is a really good term. I just thought about it. I cannot resonate. I mean, it totally makes sense in your way. I cannot resonate with it emotionally at all. I would rather call myself a cynical optimist. I mean, I think things will turn out to be great, but I think the present situation is absolutely horrifying. So, you know what I mean? It's, kind pessimism and cynical optimism.
I mean, it sounds kind of like stoicism, no?
Yeah.
A bit. I mean, both approaches, cynical optimism and kind pessimism, remind me of stoicism. This, you know, you have to kind of get on with things, even though they might turn out to be horrible.
Isn't it the same with love? I mean, you can approach love as a kind pessimist and a cynical optimist the same way. You have to, you know, navigate the ambivalences, but in the end, you still stick to it.
And you also probably do need to include an element of Delulu, because otherwise it's just not as fun. I remember once when a friend got together with a partner and another friend was like, yeah, but you know, statistically, you're not gonna last. This relationship is going to be over at some point. And, you know, yes, of course, you can approach a relationship like that, but then you also kind of take the fun out of it, perhaps. And the element of, yes, I might rationally know this, but it feels different. And it's nice to let it feel different for a while as well.
It's necessary. Because if you wouldn't do it, then you could do the exchange debt thing and, you know, say, oh, the risk is pretty high, let's raise the interest rates or whatever, you know? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think maybe the thread running through everything we've talked about today, from utopian models and digital fantasies and, you know, these ostensibly boring relationships, it is this really deep tension between, as we said before, longing and belonging, you know, about fantasizing, desiring something and actually wanting at the same time to be grounded at something, to be a part of something bigger than yourself, but on maybe on equal basis grounded in some community. And this is precisely the tension that makes love such a mixed feeling. We long for connection, for intimacy, for something that feels real and transformative, and yet the ways we try to belong in couples, communities, and fantasies or friendships, they're always shaped by social worlds around us with all their promises and limits. And maybe that's why love today feels both fragile and full of possibility. It's no longer just about who we love, but how we imagine living with one another differently. And maybe this is where the work and the hope begins. And a big thank you to my wonderful guests, Geza Jessen and Olli Liebl, for sharing their insights, their questions and reflections on love and all its messy, transformative and contradictory forms.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Paulina.
If you'd like to learn more about the research behind this conversation, check out the work of the Collaborative Research Center Affective Societies at the Freie Universität Berlin. We explore how emotions and affects shape our social worlds, from everyday relationships to global politics. You will find more information, including links to current projects, publications, and upcoming events on our website, www.sfb-affective-societies.de. And if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe, share, and let us know what you think love means today. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more mixed feelings.